an actual audio recording of an interview she had done in 1972 with Chris Van Ness of the LA Free Press. And Chris, who was at that point wheelchair bound, said, "Yeah, you guys can have the tape, but it's in my attic and I physically can't get up there." So Andy actually drove to Connecticut from his home in New York, and with Chris's guidance, like, went up to the attic, found the tape.
Hello, it is April 10th, 2024. My name is Daniel Berrios, and I'd like to welcome you to the movies. This episode is going to be an addendum to last one, where I was reviewing Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill, a documentary about the 70s singer-songwriter who took Asylum Records and David Geffen by storm, being the very first one signed to that label, which included acts like Jackson Browne, Linda Ronstadt, The Eagles, John David Souther, you know, all these big names. And yet Judy Sill kind of got lost in the background. And why is that? And what did she have to offer that the world is just slowly starting to come around and recognizing how fucking brilliant this lady is? You know, she fused blues and folk and gospel, and she was so sophisticated with her melodies. She was borrowing stuff with the Baroque period, so she's like a genre fuser, and she's creating these songs about love and trying to find one's place in the universe and being redeemed by God through all your actions. Bands like Big Thief, Ways Blood, Fleet Foxes have all cited Judy as an inspiration. So the documentary is a way to learn more about this sort of undervalued, underrated artist whom has now started to gain her, you know, place in the spotlight. And today I get to share an interview that I did with the directors of said documentary, Andy Brown and Brian Lindstrom. We got into about what it's like making a documentary when you're not a musician, about one of the best musicians that you ever heard. Got into what it's like to have the responsibility of sharing a story about somebody who is not only beloved by fans, but there's a growing consensus that, yeah, this person needed to have their story told years ago, and you're the one to take the really big swing at it. What is that like? Talked about what Judy meant to them, and a whole lot more. So let me not ramble on any further, and let me take you to my interview with the directors of Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill, Andy Brown and Brian Lindstrom. I guess I'm a star. I was asking Brian off camera but, or off record about musical backgrounds. What's your musical background?
Musical, you said?
Musical, yes.
I mean, I'm an amateur guitar player from an early age that never progressed beyond rhythm, and was in a couple bands in high school and college, but really I'm just a fan. I mean, I'm not a musician, never thought of myself as a musician. I mean, I know how to play some music, but I don't know theory. I don't know. I'm just fascinated by it, and it's my great passion my whole life. So
who is this 70s folk scene that Judy's a part of? Is that y'all's main bread and butter as far as like who's inspiring you musically? Or just what are y'all
really
into?
I mean, for me, it was classic rock. It was the Beatles and the Stones and the Who and Pink Floyd. But then I was 16 when punk hit. So it became the Clash and Sex Pistols and the Buzzcocks and Elvis Costello and Talking Heads and all those bands. And those kind of was my music, you know, in a lot of ways. But I'm pretty open now to I was a snob. I didn't like the Grateful Dead. Now I love the Grateful Dead. You know,
I have a very similar musical trajectory. But you know, it's interesting when you say like Judy being part of the folk scene. I maybe I'm being like overly like protective of Judy, but like I never think of her as being part of any scene. You know, because she's so kind of singular.
Fair. Listening to her music through the documentary, this is brand new for me. Everything with Judy is brand new. Like I saw the trailer and that was it. I had to go Spotify and listen to all that and seeing all the people that she inspired. That was saying 70s folk singer, I think, was just like easy to like wrap up because you could list off the names in the documentary, sure. The Ronstadts, and you've got Jackson Browne and J.D. Souther and all them. But with her, I think one of the things that stuck out was that she was fully formed and being able to capture all of those influences at once was just really neat to see. And to hear that y'all don't have like that, I was expecting the detail that y'all went into about her music to come from dudes that like read music and know the theory and like are really into it. Who helped y'all, I guess, flesh out the movie? I guess give some love to your researchers and all that.
Well, we're the researchers.
Yeah, we're the researchers.
Daniel, it took nearly 10 years to make this movie, so we learned a lot over the course of it about music. And from the beginning, Brian and I really wanted it to be a sophisticated musical discussion, but it was not in our sort of wheelhouse or whatever. So we knew we were going to have to rely on experts. And so they were always in the plan to have interviews with people, critics and so on, fans who could speak to the musical genius of Judy.
And we were really lucky, you know, like, you know, Tim Page, you know, we were discussing earlier, is such a delightful tour guide into Judy's musical genius, you know, and his joy and enthusiasm really kind of draw the audience in to what could be, if not done right, a rather dry aspect of the film, you know, and then also to have people like Buck Meek really break down, like, what exactly is going on and why is this music, you know, so powerful?
Yeah, I remember any interview we did where a musician was going to start to do a deep dive into the musical elements. I was like, oh, good. Because like, you know, it's like we needed that stuff, but we didn't know how necessarily on our own to say it. So someone else saying it for us who was doing it themselves at a high level or appreciated it that way, it was great, you know.
Is the process of making a documentary like this over 10 years kind of like that adage of, you know, taking 4 hours to chop down a tree and spending the first three sharpening the axe? Like, what is the process of starting out and like how far into this process do y'all finally say, okay, this is time to go. Let's start like really shooting things together. I mean, is it made in the shooting of it? Is it really made in the editing of it?
Kind of all of the above. You know, we had a lot of challenges facing us when we started this journey, and that, you know, was that we didn't know of any recorded instances of Judy's voice. Apart from
interviews,
right? Like, no, there were none. But you know, we just started out really kind of letting our love of Judy and her music guide us. It was some kind of faith that, you know, there will be a way to tell the story. We really knew we wanted to make a first person film, if at all possible. And about 4 years into the project, we were very lucky to find an actual audio recording of an interview she had done in 1972 with Chris Van Ness of the LA Free Press. And Chris, who was at that point wheelchair bound, said, yeah, you guys can have the tape, but it's in my attic. And I physically can't get up there. So Andy actually drove to Connecticut from his home in New York. And with Chris's guidance, like, went up to the attic, found the tape, and we transferred it. And at that point, we didn't know if there was any audio information on the tape. It had literally been in a box for 50 years. And when we got the transfer and we first heard, you know, those first syllables of Judy's voice, it was transformative. And it was like a eureka moment. And we knew that at that point, we could at least have Judy narrate the film. And we also wanted Judy to, you know, because she was a really gifted artist, and we knew that animation would be part of the way we would tell some of the story of the film. We wanted, in a sense, Judy to animate it. And so we used her drawings in her journals as the inspiration for our wonderful illustrator, Mia Noltin, to draw things that were then animated by Sam Neiman, our animator. And that was the animation of the film.
What I guess pieces of direction would you give to animators and the artists when it came to trying to get Judy's style? What was your goal with, I guess, how did you like push them in the right direction?
It was fairly easy because Judy was a talented drawer and artist herself. And so there were images in her journal of female figures that kind of looked like Judy a little bit. And that was sort of, you know, Mia is a very talented illustrator. She was able to right away understand what we were going for and came up with the right, you know, image of Judy for our animation out of that. It was pretty straightforward. The other thing that enabled us to also tell the story in Judy's, as if Judy's telling her own story, you know, Judy was narrating it. In the journals that we got, where the drawings were, we were able to construct a voiceover from the first, that audio tape Brian mentioned had Judy basically telling her life story up until 1972. The journals started around 73 and continued to the end of her life in 79. So we could construct a voiceover out of that, make that, put that, and have an actress read those. So now Judy was able to tell in first person her own story fully. And we also got the multi-tracks from Heart Food and her posthumous third album, Dreams Come True. And Judy scores the film as well, because we're using her multi-tracks as soundtrack. So it took a long time. It took 10 years because it took that long to accumulate all this material. And then the editing process was 2 to 3 years, you know, not working straight, but you know, when we started, when we felt ready to begin cutting it together. But that was, Brian, right? 6 years into it, maybe, when we started that, probably. Didn't start cutting until about 6 years into it.
At what point do you feel that you have enough, or like you have the right pieces to start editing?
We had the voiceover, right?
That was a huge one. And then I would also say, we knew that one challenge our film would have would be, you know, how do we kind of have a present tenseness to the film? Like, how do we avoid it just being kind of about the past? And we were very lucky, and hats off to our producer, Peter Kinney, for this. And that is that he was able to reach out to Fleet Foxes and to Adrian Lenker and Buck Meek of Big Thief and Natalie Marin. And I think that really gives the film a kind of present tense, active feel. And you kind of have a palpable sense of Judy's legacy living, you know, like her music lives on through these people.
Yeah, it's also really nice to hear their renditions of her and juxtapose that with Judy, because there's like a way that, I guess musically, there's like a way that Judy, if you imagine somebody just like writing a note, it's kind of like a stone skipping on water. But then there'll be like these little bends that she takes that like you, it's almost like a train like right about to fall off the track, but like it jumps right back on. So there's like a little bit of like danger and like a slight, ooh, what's that? Like a je ne sais quoi sort of thing about her. And so juxtaposing those, I thought, was a really cool way of getting to know her feel, her like melodic inclinations, so to speak. And I think we were talking about this earlier, like watching how she melded all the styles together was just really,
that's a really nice way of putting it. I agree with that description. I mean, of her music, not necessarily of our film.
No, y'all's worked. I liked that. I like that first personness of it. You know, was it? So when you're coming up with this, I saw like another interview where you mentioned like, y'all, somebody told Brian, hey, you should do a documentary of Judy Sill, and then boom, y'all are ready to go. Like, it's that quick? Like, it's that immediate? How many projects start out like that in your, oh, you should do this? Okay, let's go.
I would just say this was very singular because Judy moves Andy and I so deeply with not only her music, but her life story, that basically as soon as we knew that no one else had made a film about her or was making a film about her, we were pretty committed like right away to let's make this happen.
Yeah, I mean, time frame wise, I believe it was a February of 2013 where that email exchange where, you know, someone said suggested doing a story about Judy to you, and you emailed me and I about it, and I sent an email back saying, should we? And the next day or two, I was on the phone with Judy's late nephew's widow, Alicia Sill, just to kind of check in and find out, like Brian said, whether anyone had done a had one in the works. And by December, we were in LA doing our first interviews. So that's the time frame initially, 2013, of how it started. So Brian lives in Portland. I'm in New York. It was, you know, just a lot of emailing back and forth and figuring out who to interview. But we were in LA in December, and we did at least six interviews with Judy's closest friends, and you know, what
was so gratifying and inspiring about those interviews was it just cemented our conviction to make the film. Because first of all, everyone we talked to that knew Judy was like, it's about time. You know, someone should have. But also, they, to a person, all expressed just such a profound love of Judy and how she was still, all these years later, like a meaningful presence in their lives. And also that she was fun, she was loving, she was a light, you know. And it was really wonderful to kind of know that, you know, if she touched the people in her life that way, perhaps she could touch an audience the same way.
Brian is just reminding me right now that we're going to be sitting with these same people that we met over 10 years ago at the premiere in LA, which is, we talked so much about it over the years, like that's going to be really great to be sitting with Russ and Tommy, Judy's friends, some other people who knew her in a theater, hopefully, who knows. And we're actually going to be doing that a week from yesterday. So, I mean, I'm getting a little, it's just, you know, thrilling to me that we're getting to do this.
I mean, this one has been, and I mean, it's been in the works for so long, like just, and I guess you're just off the cuff reaction. Like, how does it finally feel to be like, all right, does this feel like, okay, we can breathe and kind of let this go?
Yeah,
or is this relief. Like a...
yeah, like as if like we'd been kind of entrusted with this very precious cargo for all these years, which is like Judy and her story and her music. And it's so freeing now to feel like, you know, we can let it go into the world.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but I think like that first screening we had at Doc NYC, and it's the first time I saw it projected, and I liked the movie, but I don't know if anyone else did other than our friends. And you never know with friends who
never
going to say, oh yeah, it's good, you know, but, I thought we were reasonably confident, but the reaction was really pretty positive, and especially gratifying with the Judy fanatics on the Facebook group. They all, most of them seemed to like it. And that was a nice threshold to meet. So that when I said a relief, I'm really, you know, it was in a way that we didn't mess it up, you know, like hopefully but it seems like we, you know, honor Judy in the correct way. I hope that's true.
Also, yeah, it seems like there's two camps we have to like make sure we please in some way. And that is, as Andy said, the Judy fanatics, and luckily so far so good on that front, but also the people that never knew Judy and didn't even know about her music until they see the film. And it's been really gratifying to hear from them that they really respond to the music and to her story, and that they're along for the ride.
Yeah, I was about to ask about like your goals for the film and like what responsibilities you feel, but I think you summed that up pretty well. It's a movie that, I guess, if you were to say, who do you listen to now? And it might not even be the same genre. Who do you listen to now that you think resembles that same sort of ethos? Because Judy gave me the vibe of, you know, y'all are into punk. She gave me a very punk vibe. Just like, take absolutely no shit. Be true to yourself in your chaos and like whatever, you know, vent what's in your soul. Who do y'all listen to that like echoes that same kind of ethos now?
Well, it's funny you say that, because a lot of those punks, or if you want to call them punks, you know, they were secretly folk rock, whatever you want to call it, fans. And I know Elvis Costello was a Judy Sill fan. I first heard about Judy Sill from Andy Partridge, the lead singer of XTC, who I would say their music most resembles Judy's, because Andy Partridge has frequently cited her as a major influence on him. But probably contemporary, I would say most reminds me is Wiseblood, who Natalie Merring, who's in our film. I'm sure there are others who I could come up with. I know many others who are inspired by her, but just in terms of where it's like, oh, this is very Judy-esque and has reminded me of Judy's songs. Wiseblood more than anybody, probably.
The person for me is Adrian Lenker. And I can't point to anything musically except just this complete kind of soulful fingerprint where you just hear a few notes and you know, oh, this is Judy, or oh, this is Adrian Lenker.
And the process by which Adrian creates, I think, is similar to Judy's, just sort of finding things that are in the ether.
And yeah, then, exactly. Like having such attuned antenna to what's out there and like somehow consistently catching it, you know, it's really inspiring. I also just want to echo the word responsibility. I'm so glad you used that. That's a very perceptive take on it, I think, because, you know, it's a huge responsibility to tell someone's story. You know, I mean, I hate to sound so definitive, tell her story, but, you know, it's really kind of what we're doing. And Andy and I were very conscious in doing so that we needed to honor Judy's struggle as well. You know, because to not do that would, I think, to be doing a terrible disservice to her. You know, so we really wanted to show her in all her humanity, including her struggles.
Yeah, you say
and
so
I
much
think
of
we
that.
We felt we had permission to do that because she was so brutally honest about herself with her friends and everyone she met. She would tell about all her dark history and without shame. And so I think I feel confident that she'd be okay with us having done the same in the film about her.
Seeing those last bits of journal and sort of like seeing the expression of her mental state through those writings, that I thought was a nice touch. I don't know if that was like y'all's idea to just kind of like put that in there as like sort of a visual thing, or if that was maybe inspired more by your editor, Michael Ward.
Well, he pulled it off for us, but almost everything we did was as a threesome. You know, Mike is responsible for the creative decisions as Brian and I are, I say. It's actually a very efficient way to work when you have three people because it becomes a 2-to-1 vote. And you're kind of like, it makes things go quicker.
Although I will say that I can't even recall ever having to get to that level of like, you know, who votes for this? It just seemed kind of like a really seamless way to work. And it was just all about the best idea coming to the surface. And it doesn't matter whose idea it was. It's whatever works on the film and trying any idea too, like, you know, really being open to anyone's suggestion. If it might make the film better, let's try it, you know?
And that's also partly why it took so long, because we had to try everything.
Right.
You know, all the different combinations and, you know, it was a really actually very gratifying process to be a part of creatively. I mean, I just thought it was because you're constantly making interesting creative decisions and you're dealing with material that is, we had such a great head start because her stuff is so good. So we didn't, as long as we didn't mess that up and we could harness it, you know, we were going to be in good shape. So
yeah, you got to respect it and stretch it.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting that in the sense, right. Judy informed that process as well, because the same brutal honesty that she used to examine her own life, we would use daily in the editing room, like, okay, is this scene working? Are we making the best choice right now? You know, we kind of let her guide us.
Was there ever a point y'all had to like completely recut the film? Just like start from scratch and just like, all right, we're approaching this the wrong way. Let's go right back. And
well, for the longest time, we were making the film without the benefit of any, with the exception of Sean Colvin's cover of the Phoenix, without any contemporary artists' music. You know, so that was a very different film. As soon as we got, you know, Fleet Foxes and Adrian Lenker and Natalie Merriam, it really changed the film. And we knew we were in a wonderful way, kind of back at square one, but we were very excited by that.
But I think as far as the way in which we wrestled with, should this be a chronological story? Do we tell it that way, which is a little bit cliche maybe, and tried to come up with other ways. And eventually we did sort of mostly settle on the chronological approach. It's a little jumping around at the beginning, but we did not, we were having a premiere of the film in November of 2022. And it wasn't until August of 2022 that we got the Fleet Foxes version of the Kiss. So we were recutting the opening. Really, we were trying to get the open right, and that took a while. So that was a puzzle we had to figure out, and that kind of went to the end of the, you know, when we had a deadline, we were up against it. So
it's funny, that reminds me, I think I sent a friend of the film, Tom Shadyac, the version that we had before we got the Fleet Foxes and Adrian in, mm-hmm. and Natalie Merrin. And Andy, if you'll recall, at that point, I think it started with Enchanted Sky Machines, a live mm-hmm. performance. And Tom, who liked the film a lot, but one of his first feedbacks was, you're not starting with her best song. And now in retrospect, we start with Fleet Foxes doing The Kiss, which yeah. arguably is her best song. You know, it's
right.
fun.
Right.
You can't jump too early. What's your favorite song? Is it The Kiss for both of you?
Man, it changes daily because, you know, her music is so kind of rich and profound. Like, you know, in some level, I can't think of any song of hers I don't love. But right now, my favorite song of hers is The Pearl, because to me, more than maybe any other of her songs, it kind of has Judy's, I think, main statement that I always take away from her work, which is that the things we truly need are already deep inside of us, and it was our job to uncover them.
I would typically say Loping Along Through the Cosmos, just I love that song, but really it is The Kiss, and it's specifically her version of it on the Old Grey Whistle Test, which is sort of how Brian first introduced it to you, because I've showed it to him. This is before we ever talked about making a film about her. And the way she seems to be containing all the pain of the world on her shoulders, just in her manner and the way she's playing, but she's translating it, and it's into this beautiful music. And that to me is what she's doing all the time with her music. And you're seeing it sort of personified in her performance there. So I'm going to go with that. The live version of The Kiss from the Old Grey Whistle Test.
If I could wave a magic wand and have any, like, you know, bit of footage that we could magically put in the film, it would be that the camera kept rolling so we could see Judy coming out of that performance. Because I really
curious,
what is it like to be in touch with that? And, you know, Andy beautifully described the kind of burden she's carrying, but she's also, you know, you could argue, having unburdened herself with the song. But what I would really love to see is, like, what is it like to kind of come back to here on earth at that moment, you know, after kind of being, you know, communing with the heavens.
Yeah. It's the burden of every performer, right? Like, you make some of the best songs in the world, but then you have to bring yourself to that place every single time. And so, like, I love the way that y'all in the movie, she's, you know, playing the song and then she's just like, all right, bye. It's almost like a performance, like that one, like Margot Robbie clip in Babylon, where she's like weeping and then finally like wakes up and is like, all right, we got the take, we're good. I was like, how do you connect those pieces together? So since you've started the process and you started learning about Judy, how has, like, her music, like, affected y'all as people? Like, being so attuned to who this person is for so many years, how have you found that that's kind of informed how y'all, I guess, walk across the earth, if I can get heady?
That's a great question. I think that, you know, when you spend this much time with her, like we have, you know, she lives inside of you, and, you know, you can't help but in some ways internalize not only her struggles, but maybe more importantly, her triumphs, you know. And it's easy from this vantage point, I think, to maybe judge Judy and some of her decisions. But what really comes across, just having spent all this time with her, is just her incredible strength and will to live, you know, and that she never stopped writing music. She never gave up on her muse. And, you know, through all the pain and everything, she in many ways persevered. And yes, she did have the disease of addiction, and in some just kind of, you know, brutal way, you could argue that that ultimately prevailed. But I think on a deeper level, her spirit and the way she deeply touched people lives on.
Yeah, I was just thinking when you were saying that, how I started out as a fan, and I still am, but it became something different. It became almost familial to some degree.
Right.
Because of a sort of intimate relationship that is one way, obviously. But that when I think of Judy, I think of her in terms of, in some ways, her influence on me as a person, her personal, not the musical influence on me, but on her, as Brian was saying, her struggles and her strength through her perseverance through adversity. And yeah, she had a disease of addiction, and it ultimately was stronger than her. And, but she didn't want to die. She kept writing music until the last 2-3 days before she died. She was terrified of dying of an OD, but she had a disease she, you know, that many people are not able to beat completely. And in those days, especially where there weren't the same resources for, you know, for people who were addicted as there are now. So, but anyway, my point is, though, I feel like in some ways, she's a relative, a dear relative I've never met. Yeah. And maybe I have, I don't know.
In my dream. I'm curious. When I think of Judy now, kind of in my own like personal relationship to her with her, I always think of her as a person and then as a musician. I mean, maybe that's the thing that changes when you spend this time making a documentary like this, is that you really do develop a personal relationship with the private Judy, and more so than the public.
Yeah, and it's bittersweet, obviously, because she would be so, I believe, delighted by all this, you know, what's going on. And of course, she can't enjoy it, but I never, you know, when we're in LA next week and New York, I'm going to be thinking of multiple times of how I wish she were there to see this, you know?
Yeah.
Because I feel connected to her in this way, you know?
So. And it's really going to be powerful to see like Tommy and Russ and a few others in the LA screening who knew Judy, what that's going to be like.
Do y'all have like a group chat where you're just like, oh my God, you guys are so excited, it's the premiere, oh my God.
Not yet.
As you were talking, well, I was reminded of that. Oh yeah, that's good, yeah. No, I was reminded of this movie, All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, a couple years ago, and just the subject of that movie, how she was, I saw her the same way. Like it seemed like it didn't really matter how that person, and by connection to this question, Judy, it didn't really matter what they did. It's just a matter of like the ethos with which they went about it. Like they would always find their own path, and they would, it was interesting for, I guess the stereotype about the time is like, it's the hippie movement. So like everybody's kind of lackadaisical and loosey goosey, but Judy had a really strong formal understanding of music, and just, I guess that's the genius about it. You know, we use that word and we tend to throw that around, but you know, it was a good thing to have the sheet work there and see how she's putting chords together and working on this melody. Like the second that y'all put that 16 round thing on screen, blew my fucking mind.
You know, she taught herself how to do that too. She watched her first husband, I'm sorry, her second husband do it for her on her first album, orchestrate everything. And she would sing the parts of the different instruments. But by the second album, Heart Food, which is what you're referencing, The Donor comes from, yeah, she had learned how to do that herself. So we had all the charts in her hand for all the string instruments, the oboe, the bassoon. And then, of course, she's conducting the orchestra, playing those parts. And she taught herself how to do that between the first album and the second album. She was such a perfectionist. She needed to learn so she could translate most effectively what was in her head. But that all came from just, I mean, she had perfect pitch. She was born with a great ear, obviously. She took, you know, formal piano lessons as a child. But it was something she was born with, no question. And her peers, you know, most of them would say that she was the most talented. Many of them would say she's the most talented amongst them, her label mates, you know.
Even on that, even on our first album, you know, as Jim Pond says in the film, who was one of the producers, that, you know, all the producers really had to do was turn the machine on. You know, even then she knew what she wanted and how to achieve it.
Yeah, that was rad. All right, I'm watching the Zoom timer go down. It's like almost a minute. So I usually end my episodes by playing a song for folks. What Judy song should I play?
What do you think, Brian? Put the pearl on.
You want pearl? Well, maybe Lamb Ran Away with the Crown in honor of Tim Page.
Okay.
All right, here's to you, Tim Page. And
love
here's
you,
to
Tim.
You, Judy Sill. And thank you, Brian and Andy. And that's a wrap on my interview with directors Andy Brown and Brian Lindstrom. I hope y'all got as much out of that as I did. It was an excellent conversation. And Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill, drops on Apple TV and Amazon April 12th. I hope y'all are able to rent and pick that one up as soon as possible, because I think it's a movie that's going to be well worth your time. And if this is your introduction to Judy Sill, what a way to do so, from, you know, two gents who clearly love her music, love her, and wanted to do her story the most justice possible. I know they are in respectively Portland and New York hosting screenings of the movie before flying to LA on the 12th for the premiere. So I want to say a personal congratulations to you, you two, Andy and Brian. 10 years of hard work, 10 years of trying to tell this story with as much love and care and detail as possible. I am happy that for y'all, it's finally time to birth this baby of sorts into the world. And thank you for listening to another episode of The Movies. If you want to follow me, you can do so on Twitter at @themovies_pod. I'm also going to try to be a little bit more active on Good Pods. It's not like Spotify or Apple, where it just seems like podcasting is part of the program and part of the music. No, this is an entire platform. If you love podcasts and you cannot stop stuffing your ear holes with them, this is the place for you. So I'm going to try to be a little bit more active on there. So like they mentioned, I'm going to close this bad boy out with The Lamb Ran Away with the Crown. I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. I hope you all take a liking to Judy too. If you really like her stuff, I recommend Sunday Drive, preferably in a woodland area, and just let Judy serenade you the entire way. I think it would make for a great time and a great introduction to a stellar, underrated songwriter. So yeah, let me stop rambling. This is Lamb Ran Away with the Crown. My friends, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and take care of the movies. Ba-da-da. Once I heard a serpent remark, if you try to evoke the spark, you can fly through the dark with the red midnight raven to rule the battleground. So I drew my sword and got ready, but the lamb ran away with the crown. So I drew my sword and got ready.